Good morning, everybody, and we are resuming the study of indeterminates and cosmic determinations. And last time we covered that one large paragraph which begins, "But neither is the separate cognition of them entirely an illusion." And we read the next paragraph. So, you know, in a nutshell, to go back to that last paragraph we did and bring us in context, there Sri Aurobindo is talking about the dualities, and particularly the duality that he has introduced in this chapter, which is that of the difference between any form of determination, in other words, a causality in the cosmos, and something which is beyond all causality. And he's pointed out earlier that radically infinite being has to be beyond all causality. Yet, causality exists in it. And so one thing which we realize and which we can ask is, why is this concern of importance to Sri Aurobindo? And particularly in this book called The Life Divine, what is the place of this idea or of this this duality? And I think to get a certain perspective on that is helpful, because in a way we can say that this entire book is a case, a thesis, as one may say, a case for the establishment of a ordering principle within radical infinity. In other words, inherent in Brahman, inherent in being, in reality, is a organ of knowledge. Now, the reason such a concern is important is that the idea of meaning, is there meaning to this cosmos? We ask that question because we can take the cosmos as a given which is random, and we can also take it that it is a determined cosmos. These are the two ways in which we can look at it. Now, the sense of meaning, if we ask what is meaning, we find that that question arises particularly with human beings, because we have an intuition of meaning. That intuition of meaning may be something which is a conditioning factor for us. In other words, it's innate to humans but has no real correlate in the cosmos, in reality. So that question is something which we, that is the question of the indeterminate and the presence of determinations within the indeterminate. Those who have answered that question in the affirmative are seeing that there is a certain kind of validation to our intuition of meaning in the cosmos. That the cosmos is meaningful, in other words. Or what do we mean by meaning there? In other words, how far does it go? Are we looking for a single answer or cause out of which everything has come? Or is there something which is so inherent that it transcends any particular causality that we can attribute to the cosmos, and yet it is the cause of all causes? See what Aristotle called the unmoved mover. So, from that point of view, from that philosophical questioning, different cultures, different philosophers, different yogis have given different answers. And the one of the problems we face, particularly with the Indian spiritual tradition, is that it has either, I mean, I'm not talking about the Vedas and the Upanishads, but the post-Upanishadic literature has either denied the presence of any meaning or attributed this kind of meaning as a fixed sort of determinism of the cosmos. Fixed determinism of the cosmos in the Indian context is when we say that there is a meaning to this cosmos, but it is fated or destined to be fixed as a avidya. In other words, a form of ignorance. It's bound to remain like this for eternity because it's a kind of a visage, a play of God. The views that hold a reality to the cosmos, such as Vaishnavism or Shakti traditions, these are the two major traditions that give validation to the reality of the cosmos. Even they basically hold that this is a permanent condition of ignorance. So the play of God, where he has disguised himself in a certain way and will hold on to that disguise, so that we accept that disguised appearance and say that that's the best that's available here, in other words. The other traditions have affirmed that there is no meaning. In other words, that this is a meaningless cosmos, an illusory cosmos. In all these cases, the end result is that we are being asked to leave this cosmos. We can, in the world-affirming philosophies, see something in the cosmos which is, behind the disguises. But to live there, either we have to go into the cave and constantly behold that, witness that condition, or live in a very high state of consciousness where one accepts the disguise but knows that nobody else really knows that there is a disguise. See, so there is a kind of a play where one sees the leela of the divine everywhere, but that leela is only something that the realized person sees. One can give an example as, for Sri Aurobindo in Alipur jail seeing Krishna sitting in the heart of all human beings. So that kind of an experience, if it can be made constant, is one in which the ignorance reveals the disguised play of the divine, and that becomes the truth of the ignorance. See, so that in a sense gives us a reason or a meaning to the cosmos. But that meaning is fated to be always of that kind, something which can never remove the veil, so to say. So under these conditions, the critical or crucial importance of trying to establish that there is meaning to the cosmos, which is not merely static, nor something which is intangible, goes out of the cosmic realms, becomes very important for Sri Aurobindo if he has to establish that there is the possibility of a divine life here. So that's, one may say, the motive behind chapters like this. And what he's trying to say here is that we come across these dualities, particularly this duality of order and chaos, for example, or the way of understanding everything, coming to understand things in the cosmos, and entering into a space where all sense of understanding is overcome or is transcended. These two are two aspects of the radical infinity of the divine or of reality. And they coexist. And in our condition, we can experience both of them. When we experience through the mind establishes these dualities as definitive and latches on to one or the other side, affirming it as a reality. So this is a problem that we have faced. So this is the reason we come up with all the wars of ideas that characterizes our existence. Ultimately, apart from purely vital wars, wars which have to do with desire, all other wars are wars of ideas. See, and our present age is just riddled with the wars of ideas because of this reason, this problem with the mind. However, he's saying that it is possible to hold these relative views separately as having relative realities. In over mind, one may say that such a experience is possible. In such an experience, we would find that we can utilize each of these views to some effect. As he points out in that paragraph we have just covered, that any understanding or law that we can find to the cosmos can be transcended. In other words, we can refuse reality to it. We can go through a process of negation, which is, in theological terms, this is called negative theology. Negative theology or apophatic theology proceeds by negating anything that can be said of reality. So long as we can describe it, that is not it. That is the stand it takes, until we arrive at an indescribable. Or perhaps the indescribable is always with us, and whatever we can describe of it is not part of its essence. See, so we are trying to arrive at that essence. On the other hand, he says that if we could move through an inclusive process towards an infinity, in other words, whatever we know or understand is a expanding content, we can know more and more, and naturally the validation of the cosmos proceeds along that line. That is the in the modern paradigm of science, that's how we approach the material universe and proceed from there into the non-material, so to say. So he's saying that there is reality to both of these. And reality itself is ultimately unconditioned and unconditionable, and yet it can present itself in forms that are conditioned or determined. Now, what this means, and that's the point that he's making, that the central point, is that reality has within it a capacity to view itself as having order. In other words, it can know itself. It has an organ of knowledge. Just as we have a sense of self-evident being, if you ask somebody, how do you know that you exist? You know, if you really probe yourself with that question, you'll find that it's a silly question because you know that you exist. That's the self-evidence of that experience. So to reality as conscious being knows that it exists. Its existence is primordial, without beginning and end, and self-evident. Yet it can describe its knowledge of itself. Now this description of its knowledge of itself is also primordial. This is the point that he's making, that just as we have an organ of knowledge with which we can turn upon our existence and try to describe it, though that description will always fall short of the self-evident knowledge that we have of ourselves, so too that organ of knowledge has its origin in what we may call God's own organ of knowledge, reality as knowledge, reality which has the power of grasping its own radical infinity as order. See, so this way of knowing oneself as an order is part of the faculty of God, or it's part of the consciousness of God. To be conscious includes to know. See, so knowledge, you may say chit jnana, the consciousness as knowledge, is what he's talking about. And this is what the Western traditions have called logos. So logos, in its deepest sense, in its highest sense, is God's, is the word, as he says, you know, God's faculty of knowing itself, or reality's faculty of knowing itself. And that is why this is very important, because if indeed in the highest, in the origin of things, there is a faculty of knowing, a faculty of seeing its entirety as a form of some kind, that means that in the manifestation, it should be possible to have the coherence of that faculty, though in kind it may be different from what we experience. This is the basis of what he's trying to get at over here. And he's saying, to get there, we must accept these dualities, the duality of determination and the duality of that which can negate or erase determination at any point, to move into a greater and greater infinity, so that we arrive at something like a infinite regression, or even an infinite recursion, where you can say that to any order there is a greater power of transcendence or of erasure of that order, and to any disorder there is a greater power of order. This is a infinite series of successions. So that's where we end that particular paragraph, and I end with the last lines of that paragraph, where he's saying how this sequence or series is observed or is experienced by different levels of consciousness. In mind, the knowledge of the unity of all, well, he begins with the supermind keeps always and in every status or condition the spiritual realization of the unity of all. In other words, there is an organ of God in which this radical infinity and the radical sense of knowing oneself coexist. That is supermind. And that holds to the realization of the unity of all. The intimate presence of that unity is there even within the completest grasp of each thing, each state, given its whole delight of itself, power and value. There is thus no losing sight of the affirmative aspects, even when there is the full acceptance of the truth of the negative. They coexist in the same experience, in the same perception and experience. The overmind keeps still the sense of this underlying unity. That is for it the secure base of the independent experience. Yet one may say in overmind there has been a separation of the two as coexisting realities. See, underlying it there is the sense that this is the same reality with two properties, but there has been a projection of those properties as independent realities. In mind, the knowledge of the unity of all aspects is lost on the surface. The consciousness is plunged into engrossing exclusive separate affirmations. But there too, even in the mind's ignorance, the total reality still remains behind the exclusive absorption and can be recovered in the form of a profound mental intuition or else in the idea or sentiment of an underlying truth of integral oneness. So this is where he's saying that if we approach through the logic, see, logos has logic, you see, so we approach through logic of the external intelligence, then we arrive at all kinds of problems. And this is the nature of what he's calling the external mind's problem in the engrossment of exclusive realities that are separated from each other. But behind it, and that's where he's pointing to what he has called the inner mind. The inner mind and the higher cosmic mind ranges have a more flexible understanding of reality. And so, but there we come to other kinds of logics, not necessarily the logic of the external mind, but the logic of paradox, for example, which is being used in mystic texts like the Upanishads. The logic of symbolism, which is being used in mystic texts like the Veda. The logic of poetic understanding. See, and ultimately, we also have a certain kind of a sense in the mind. This is the intuition that he's talking about. And that is something that he'll call samgyana. Samgyana is a certain mystic sense with which we can understand what the logic cannot understand. We can experience at an intuitive level what the logic cannot understand. So he's saying that the coherence of the cosmos and its radical infinity coexist and can be understood or intuited at a deeper level of the mind. And that's what he's saying, that because that exists, we are given a track of progress from where we are to the origin from which we have come, from mind to overmind to supermind, retaining this kind of link. In the spiritual mind, this can develop into an ever-present experience. So he's actually inviting us to the spiritual mind. And by spiritual mind here, he means that internal track by which we establish a connection from supermind through overmind all the way down until the inner mind plane. And we can exist in that particular consciousness.
Shall we read the first paragraph?
Sure.
I can go first. All aspects of the omnipresent reality have their fundamental truth in the supreme existence. Thus, even the aspect or power of inconscience, which seems to be an opposite, a negation of the eternal reality, yet corresponds to a truth held in itself by the self-aware and all-conscious infinite. It is, when we look closely at it, the infinite's power of plunging the consciousness into a trance of self-involution, a self-oblivion of the spirit veiled in its own abysses, where nothing is manifest but all inconceivably is, and can emerge from that ineffable latency. In the heights of spirit, this state of cosmic or infinite trance sleep appears to our cognition as a luminous, uttermost superconscience. At the end of being, it offers itself to cognition as the spirit's potency of presenting to itself the opposites of its own truths of being, an abyss of non-existence, a profound night of inconscience, a fathomless swoon of insensibility from which yet all forms of being, consciousness and delight of existence can manifest themselves. But they appear in limited terms, in slowly emerging and increasing self-formulations, even in contrary terms of themselves. It is a play of a secret all-being, all-delight, all-knowledge, but it observes the rules of its own self-oblivion, self-opposition, self-limitation, until it is ready to surpass it. This is the inconscience and ignorance that we see at work in the material universe. It is not a denial, it is one term, one formula of the infinite and eternal existence.
So, as we see that, you know, he's pointing to the fact that reality is one, and everything within it is within the grasp of the supermind, and hence everything has meaning from that point of view. And this is the point he's making here about the inconscient and the meaning or truth of the inconscient. So, again, these, whatever it is that reality is, the Brahman, Satchidananda, whatever name we want to give it, its appearance to itself is reality itself. In other words, it can view itself in any way possible. And these ways through which it views itself are always reality. They are eternal realities. And every possible way by which or through which it can view itself is simultaneous and coexistent. In other words, infinite ways of viewing itself coexist as realities. That's what allows this, you know, this knowledge of God, if you want to call it knowledge, you know, is valid. So in that knowledge, we can see a certain way by which it can view itself coherently as a spectrum of ranges of consciousness. And that spectrum of ranges of consciousness has no upper limit and no lower limit. The limits that are only set by what we can, you know, the scale at which we can observe it, or the scale at which we can experience it. So we can say that it's how objective can it become? How dense can it become? How deep a sleep can it enter into? How inconscient can it become? And so we enter into an infinity of inconscience. At the other end, we enter into an infinity of pure consciousness. So there is these two poles to the spectrum, as it were, of the way in which it can grade its own being in terms of degrees of consciousness. And so when we talk about inconscience, we can also look at it. There's another place where Sri Aurobindo says that from a certain point of view, we can say that there is nothing but matter. And we are absolutely right. There is nothing but matter. From another point of view, we can say there is nothing but spirit. And again, we are absolutely right. And he says the reason is that there is no difference between the two. They are the same thing. And they are forms of self-perception. So when we say that, you know, there is pure subject, there is pure conscious being, we can say that it is not objectified at all to itself, then we are talking of an infinity of spirit, or infinity of conscious substance. On the other hand, if we say that there is pure object, in other words, there is nothing to be kind of be conscious of, In other words, all consciousness has entered into a profound latency, an abyss, an oblivion of self, then we can call it matter. See? So both these poles, polarities, both these infinities are infinities of the same. And they are just forms of self-perception. And in a way, it sort of relates to what he has said earlier about determinations and the indeterminable, that it can have these ways, these polarities of self-perception that coexist and in the experience seem to exclude each other. But due to the nature of radical infinity, they do not actually exclude each other, but are part of the self-knowledge of the divine. So this is what he's saying over here, and he's pointing to the special property of this self-oblivion, which is the material inconscience. And he's saying that it makes it possible for a manifestation from this end where the latencies that inhere in the pure object, in the objective condition, pure material objectivity, begin to emerge in a graded form, in slowly emerging and increasing self-formulations, even in contrary terms of themselves. So yeah, the subject emerges from the object. You see, this is out of the involution of subject, we see the dark inconscience, the dark infinity of inconscience, and out of the total evolution of subject, we emerge at the bright or luminous infinity of the superconscience. So these are the two polarities unendingly in relation. The dialectics of the polarity is a productive dialectics. It's a yantra, in other words, a machine, or what in medieval, Europe used to be called the perpetual motion machine. A machine that is so set up inherently that it needs no energy to run it. It will run forever. See? So this is a self-perception that is productive in that sense, that it sets up a dialectical relationship that will go forever. And this dialectical relationship is exactly the symbol of Sri Aurobindo, which is the two triangles, the triangle from above and the triangle from below, that are meshing together and producing the manifestation through their interaction.
When we say it's self-perception, it's how we perceive whether it's all as matter and all as spirit. What is modulating or changing that perception as we grow? What is it that is changing in the perception? Is the perception its own reality, or what is it in the perception that is changing its characteristic, that we perceive things differently as we grow?
What I'm saying is that no, it is not our self-perception. It is Brahman's self-perception. It is reality's own self-perception. So, in other words, that which is radically infinite can perceive itself in infinite ways. And it can perceive itself either as completely unconstrained, a kind of a pure subject, and it can perceive itself as completely constrained or as pure object, you see. So both are infinities, and these infinities are self-perceptions of the divine that coexist, but are self-perceptions. In other words, they are perceiving the same thing. They are perceiving the self. Both are the same thing. To our perception, they are two different things. That's where what you're asking differs from God's self-perception or the supermind self-perception. The supermind self-perception is that it is an infinity of perceptions that coexist in its experience. So it's experiencing these realities at the same time as experiences of the same. On the one hand, the experience of pure subject, the other hand, the experience of pure object, and then all the experiences in between. These are all, each one of them is a self-perception, perception of the self, by the self. And in our case, what happens is that due to the nature of the emergent properties of consciousness from the inconscience, we naturally see these as two different realities, two infinities that are in relation, in dialectical relation with each other. And that perception is something which can either first affirm one over the other, or the other over the one, or what it can do is slowly emerge into a unity in which it starts seeing that there are all these gradations in between, and this is, the whole thing is a description of the same, seen from different points of view. It's a self-description of the divine that is an evolution arising out of these two self-perceptions that have been put in relation with each other. Self-perceptions can exist without relation. In other words, we may say that, you know, the divine can perceive itself as pure matter, and the divine can perceive itself as pure spirit. So what? On the other hand, self-perceptions can be put in relation with each other. And this is what happens when we say that, you know, that there is a emergent forms of consciousness in matter, and these emergent forms naturally are looking towards greater releases in spirit, and so they are immediately in relation with another pole, which is the pole of the pure subject or the pure spirit. And that is what is changing. That's what's changing in our perception, not in the perception of the divine. Well, you could say it's the perception of the divine too, because as he's saying, our constituent reality is the evolution of the divine. So it is the divine who is undergoing a certain evolution through, and that is also one of its self-perceptions. And that self-perception is us. So that's what's changing over there.
Okay. So, yeah. So when we use these words, we are using it in the context of the Brahman's experience rather than our personal experience.
Yeah, that's why he's making a distinction between three kinds of experiences: the experience of supermind, to which, as I said, these are self-perceptions that coexist all simultaneously. And it's like that's the description, the knowledge of God, like where Sri Aurobindo says at one point, I'm not interested in man's knowledge of God, but God's knowledge of himself. See, so far we've been trying to arrive at man's knowledge of God. You know, how do we describe that which seems to be alien to us? But how does God know himself? That God's organ of self-knowledge is supermind. And so that supramental knowledge, there is a self-description that is going on, which is a simultaneous self-description of all its possibilities. The very fact that it has infinite possibilities also means that it has infinite ways of looking at itself. Each one of those possibilities is a self-perception. And these simultaneous self-perceptions are ordered along a range, if it wants to see itself as ordered, It's ordered along a range which enters into an infinity of pure conscious being and an infinity of pure objective materiality or in conscience. Now, in all these self-perceptions, the totality of Brahman is present. So, in conscience, a matter is nothing other than Brahman, but Brahman which is perceiving itself in that particular form. Now, when those two perceptions are put in relation, then we have the entire spectrum of consciousness that emerges as a result of that relation. The beings within that emergent spectrum will view these as different realities. You know, it's sort of being, it's like being in intermediate realities, and each of those intermediate realities having its own reality, and therefore being able to perceive different forms of Brahman as realities.
Thank you. Keka, would you like to read next?
Chotti, toke bolchi tui porbi kina.
She's not there. Dan Wood?
Sure.
Hello?
Oh, okay. Dan, maybe you can read next. Keka, we weren't hearing you for a second. Are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, so go ahead. Dan, you can read after this.
That it is important to observe?
No, this is the paragraph starting with, it is important to observe.
It is important to observe here the sense that is acquired in such a total cognition of cosmic being by the phenomenon of the ignorance, its assigned place in the spiritual economy of the universe. If all that we experience were an imposition, an unreal creation in the absolute, both cosmic and individual existence would be in their very nature an ignorance. The sole real knowledge would be the indeterminable self-awareness of the Absolute. If all were the erection of a temporal and phenomenal creation over against the reality of the witnessing timeless eternal, and if the creation were not a manifestation of the reality, but an arbitrary, self-effective cosmic construction, that too would be a sort of imposition. Our knowledge of the creation would be the knowledge of a temporary structure of evanescent consciousness and being, a dubious becoming that passes across the vision of the eternal, not a knowledge of reality. That too would be an ignorance. But if all is a manifestation of the reality and itself real by the constituting immanence, the substantiating essence and presence of the reality, then the awareness of the individual being and world being would be in its spiritual origin and nature a play of the infinite self-knowledge and all knowledge. Ignorance could be only a subordinate movement, a suppressed or restricted cognition, or a partial and imperfect evolving knowledge with a true and total self-awareness and all-awareness concealed both in it and behind it. It would be a temporary phenomenon, not the cause and essence of cosmic existence, its inevitable consummation would be a return of the spirit, not out of the cosmos to a soul supracosmic self-awareness, but even in the cosmos itself to an integral self-knowledge and all knowledge. May I read the last sentence one more time? It would be a temporary phenomenon, not the cause and essence of cosmic existence. Its inevitable consummation would be a return of the spirit, not out of the cosmos to a soul, supracosmic self-awareness, but even in the cosmos itself, to an integral self-knowledge and all knowledge.
So, yeah, here he is bringing the argument to a close, and as we can see, he's pointing to the importance, and that's where the whole paragraph begins with, it is important here to observe. This idea, and it's for the very reason that we spoke of at the start of this session, that to validate the existence in this material cosmos of a divine reality and the possibility, in fact the inevitability, as he is pointing out over here, of a divine life, one has to see that this kind of a self-perception of reality by the Supreme or by conscious existence, infinite existence, is going on, and that it spawns as part of its reality a evolving ignorance. That is what we observe, and experiencing it as an ignorance, we take it to be something which is unreal. I mean, either the kind of views that the ignorance itself projects as its own reality are in the majority this kind of a invalidation of any truth to itself or to the divine, either of the two. So we could either say that, you know, there is only a certain, there is nothing called meaning or nothing called God or nothing called meaning. It's a random play of a determined cosmos, tightly determined cosmos with various forces in it, and those forces are playing themselves out over here. There's nothing outside it, where it has come from. There is no answer to that question. That question is an irrelevant question. And, you know, whatever we call consciousness is just a kind of a accident. It's what they call an epiphenomenon. It's a sort of a resultant phenomenon of the growth of material accidents. On the other hand, we could say that though there is something, and that whatever there is, which is truly conscious, has created this particular phenomenon that we call the material universe, the creator-creation relationship, and we experience this world in the way in which we experience it because that's the way in which it is. And then that spawns a variety of mid-explanations, intermediate explanations, such as that of perhaps heavens and hells, you know, a condition in which we find ourselves haplessly due to some bad karma which we did, or a condition which is just a sort of a disordered dream of Brahman, the illusory concept. In other words, if we say that radical infinity is indeterminable, we can also say that in its self-conceptions, there can exist a variety of completely random, irrelevant self-perceptions. In other words, disordered dreams. And we could say that this is one of those disordered dreams. It is completely meaningless, and it has arbitrary elements in it in which consciousness finds itself trapped. And so our experience is that entrapment. And yet, because consciousness exists in it, we can somehow try to find our way out of it. So that becomes one of those impositions, as he says, you know, the kind of imposition upon the spirit. Or, as he says, another argument is that it could be the erection of a temporal and phenomenal creation over against the reality of the witnessing timeless eternal. So it's a construction, just as we construct, you know, fanciful edifices in our imagination. This is a temporary construction without any meaning. It's not a disordered dream, but a temporary construction. But, and we happen to find ourselves as participants or, you know, subjected entities within that construction. The best thing we can do is get out of it. So he's saying, to all these views, there is the idea that there cannot be a self-perception of Brahman in which everything within it cannot be other than the Brahman. See? So, but that is almost, that is a given if there is nothing but Brahman. Sri Aurobindo's argument, if you want to call it a logical argument, is proceeding on the central axis or the central flagpole of the Upanishads, which says there is nothing but the Brahman. You see, that is the central pillar on which the entire Vedanta is standing. There is nothing but the Brahman. And if there is nothing but the Brahman, then any appearance or construction of the Brahman has to be nothing but the Brahman. And that's what he's pointing to over here, and saying that these other constructions and explanations of illusory ignorance don't take into account this reality, that this is also nothing but the Brahman. And if it is, I mean, we are not saying that it is nothing but a part of the Brahman, but it is nothing but the entirety of the Brahman. See? And that is where he's pointing out towards the end, that if all is a manifestation of the reality and itself real by the constituting immanence, the substantiating essence and presence of the reality, then the awareness of individual being and world being would be, in its spiritual origin and nature, a play of the infinite self-knowledge and all knowledge. Now this is the thesis throughout this particular chapter, that Brahman has become this universe, or Brahman has become this reality that we experience as an evolving ignorance. And it has become it through three ways, and that's what he's pointing to in that sentence. A constituting immanence. A constituting immanence means that the constituents of material existence are the Brahman. That is, in every particle of atom is the Brahman. You see, that is the constituting immanence. Then there is the substantiating essence. The substantiating essence is what might be called the transcendent within the immanent. In other words, apart from all these particles that form the independent material existences that we can call beings and entities in the cosmos, is a force. There is a principle and a force which is the involution of Shakti in and as the cosmos, the essence of the cosmos. That particular involved Shakti is driving the motivating power of the constituents of the cosmos. But that, if that was all, then we would say the constituents have no real play. This is something we sort of discussed a little earlier in this chapter, that each constituent, each entity, each atom, each object has got the entirety of the Brahman present in it. And that is, in a sense, the Purusha. Just as the animating essence is the Prakriti, or the Shakti, the involution of Prakriti, is what he's calling over here the substantiating essence, involution of Purusha and Prakriti at the level of the bedrock principle and animating essence. And the presence of the reality, the presence of the reality is ultimately the fact that Brahman holds all this together, that there is nothing but the Brahman outside it as well as inside it. And it is that presence that is imbuing the whole of it with reality. See? So these three forms, two forms of immanence and one form of presence, is what gives reality to this cosmos. And he's, as he's pointing out, it is an evolving ignorance and hence a temporary condition, which not a permanent fixed condition, but a temporary condition in which the gradations of consciousness are being are emerging and forming this entire ladder of manifestation, connecting the infinity of involution to the infinity of complete evolved self-aware superconscience. So he's saying it would be a temporary phenomenon, not the cause and essence of cosmic existence. Its inevitable consummation would be a return of the spirit, not out of the cosmos to a soul supracosmic self-awareness, but even in the cosmos itself, to an integral self-knowledge and all knowledge. So here we find that this validation of the Brahman as integrally present in all its constituents and in what we call material reality itself is something which coincides with the Spinozan view that what we call matter or what we experience is the totality of the divine, that within it are all the possibilities of the divine. But what the Spinozan view does not encompass is the fact that this particular divine, the material divine, if you want to call it, is in perpetual dialectical relationship with its opposite pole, the pole of pure superconscience. And it is that which makes the evolution possible and inevitable. See, the evolution proceeds due to that. Moreover, within that, each constituent or each constituting entity is the entirety of the Brahman. And this is what makes possible the growth of the evolution of Purusha. So there are two evolutions going on. There's one place in which Sri Aurobindo points to two evolutions going on in terms of this very productive duality that I just spoke about. He says there are two evolutions going on. The evolution of matter, spawning greater and greater liberations of the spirit within its embodied imprisonment, and the evolution of spirit, housing itself in more and more perfect forms of manifest substance. See, these two evolutions are actually one evolution. But yet, from each viewpoint, it is an evolution. We can only see the lower half of the evolution. But to other beings, to God Himself, you may say, there is another kind of evolution going on, a top-down evolution, simultaneously with the bottom-up evolution. Again, we can talk about two evolutions within the material cosmos. One is the evolution of nature or of Prakriti, which by that substantiating essence is causing to emerge new principles of consciousness in the cosmos and new conditions of embodiment. New conditions of embodiment, both individual and collective. And the second evolution is the evolution of Purusha, by which personhood is emerging, so that ultimately there'll be a world of entities, each of whom can completely manifest the manifold Purusha, the manifold person, as Brahman, as person. So these are all made possible by this productive dialectic between the two polarities through which conscious being perceives itself and puts itself in relation.
Dan Wood, would you like to read next?
Sure.
So, looks like there are two short paragraphs to close out the chapter. Do we want to read them both, or does it make sense to read their conclusion separately?
We can read them both. I'm fine with that. We can read them both and conclude.
Go ahead, Dan.
Okay. It might be objected that the supramental cognition is, after all, not the final truth of things. Beyond the supramental plane of consciousness, which is an intermediate step from overmind and mind, to the complete experience of Satchitananda, are the greatest heights of the manifested spirit. Here, surely, existence would not at all be based on the determination of the one in multiplicity. It would manifest solely and simply a pure identity in oneness. But the supramental truth consciousness would not be absent from these planes, for it is an inherent power of Satchitananda. The difference would be that the determinations would not be demarcations. They would be plastic, interfused, each a boundless finite. For there, all is in each, and each is in all, radically and integrally. There would be, to the utmost, a fundamental awareness of identity, a mutual inclusion and interpenetration of consciousness. Knowledge, as we envisage it, would not exist because it would not be needed, since all would be direct action of consciousness in being itself, identical, intimate, intrinsically self-aware and all-aware. But still, relations of consciousness, relations of mutual delight of existence, relations of self-power of being, with self-power of being would not be excluded. These highest spiritual planes would not be a field of blank indeterminability, a vacancy of pure existence.
You can read that last paragraph also, Dan.
Okay. It might be said again that, even so, in Satchitananda itself, at least, above all worlds of manifestation, there could be nothing but the self-awareness of pure existence and consciousness, and a pure delight of existence. Or, indeed, this triune being itself might well be only a trinity of original spiritual self-determinations of the infinite. These two, like all determinations, would cease to exist in the ineffable absolute. But our position is that these must be inherent truths of the supreme being, their utmost reality must be pre-existent in the absolute, even if they are ineffably other there than what they are in the spiritual mind's highest possible experience. The absolute is not a mystery of infinite blankness, nor a supreme sum of negations. Nothing can manifest that is not justified by some self-power of the original and omnipresent reality.
So here, Sri Aurobindo is drawing the distinction between the supermind plane, the plane of meaning, of cause, of knowledge, and existences beyond the supermind plane. So, as we are saying, that if reality is radically infinite and free of all determinations, at a certain point, any possibility of self-determination is withdrawn. And it is as if, as I was mentioning, the self-evident self-knowledge of the One comes into play. It's not reflexive anymore. It doesn't turn its gaze upon itself anymore. It doesn't try to describe itself anymore. So, the supermind plane, the plane of knowledge, the plane of cognition, self-cognition, is superseded. And we have, as it were, planes of existence in which there is no need for knowledge. And so, this becomes important because, again, as I said, particularly in the Eastern traditions, this view of ignorance as a permanent condition of some entrapment, of imprisonment, has persisted. And there has been an attempt to posit an escape into a completely undetermined world, a world that has no relation with this world, because it is felt that any relation with this world would constrain it within some kind of determinable formula, some sort of finitude. And pure infinity cannot but escape into some beyond, outside of that. In the Western traditions, there has always been a fear of that. So that even when a thinker like Kant talks about forms of beauty, he acknowledges the fact that the beautiful, what he calls the aesthetic emotion arises through a perception of order, intrinsic order, in what seems to be chaotic. So particularly when we observe this interplay of the random and the chaos, and the ordered, and intuit a improbable order within reality, it gives us great pleasure. It gives us great happiness. And that is what he calls the aesthetic emotion. If something is symmetric, totally symmetric, we get derive a certain level of pleasure from it. But it is not as great as if there is an intuited symmetry behind something which is asymmetrical. The asymmetrical that breaks symmetry, but implies it, even in its breaking, gives us greater pleasure because we intuit an order within it. So this is how we are related to our own cosmos with which we are in relationship, trying to intuit that sense of order. But Kant points out that, again, radical infinity, reality being radically infinite, the absolute with a capital A, as he says in that last paragraph, ultimately being indescribable, completely indescribable, we are often faced with that to which there is no order, and which is radically infinite in the sense of being radically chaotic. And that impression of infinity, that intimation of infinity, is something that is tinged with fear for human beings, that always comes to us with fear. And that's what he says about the sublime experience, the emotion of the sublime. The emotion of the sublime, for Kant, arises when we come into contact with an infinity too great to intuit any order in. So the sublime makes us, as it were, awestruck. We are full of awe about it. But at the same time, what gives us a certain kind, an emotion which is positive within that, is our knowledge that through our own mental faculties, we have created constructions which can give us security from that invading infinity. See, we can look at a storm from the vantage of our house, for example, which is a level of the operation of the mind that has constructed something using the laws of nature to give us a greater survival power against the infinity of nature. So that knowledge adds a certain positive emotional component to our sense of awe in the face of radical infinity. So this is how the Western tradition has viewed man's relation with radical infinity, either from the positive viewpoint of intuiting an order within it, or from the viewpoint of creating an order which can give us some staying power within the radical infinity. The Eastern view, on the other hand, has tried to escape from any sense of order into a pure, indeterminable absolute. See? Now, what Sri Aurobindo is contending over here is that even beyond any manifestation of a self-knowledge by reality, beyond the supramental plane, there will still exist a sense of some knowledge. In other words, knowledge is inherent in Satchidananda. And the way he is pointing to about it over here is that in these planes, which in the Vedantic tradition are known as the planes of existence, consciousness, and bliss, there is still relations can exist within these planes. There can be relations, there can be a manifestation, but such a manifestation would have a different quality of consciousness. Now, what would be such a quality of consciousness? And the mother was asked this question regarding what is the experience of reality in supermind and what is the experience of reality beyond supermind. And she has given an answer in which she says, the reason supermind adds coherence to our existence is because it orders reality. It gives us a sense of time and place which is coherent. So we can see sequences that have a plot to them, that have a certain kind of, kind of layout to them. But if we were to think about an experience in which we were in a certain time and place at a certain instant, and in a completely different time and place in the next instant, such an experience is possible in Satchidananda, without the operation of supermind. You see, so, for example, a certain reality in a certain time and place, time-space event, would not have any relationship with the next time-space event in each individual entity. They would be able to move from one to another. Now, what Sri Aurobindo is saying over here is that even then, it would that kind of an experience would seem to be totally unconstrained and without any coherence to our consciousness here in the ignorance. But to Satchidananda, the quality of consciousness would be completely different. And these movements, even if that was the case, such movements would be self-determined movements. And such self-determined movements would be movements of the one upon the one. So any relations we have would actually be completely coherent. We would know both in ourselves and in those with whom we are in contact what kind of reality is being experienced as a certain possibility of being which is manifesting. So the order would be very different. It would seem to be completely unordered, but nevertheless it would have within it an inherent power of identity and knowledge as well, through which it would be able to communicate in its manifestation. This is the point he's making. And then from that, he's moving to an even greater or even more transcendental condition. Because after all, even if we talk of Satchidananda, this is within what we call the manifest appearance, the self-presentation of the radically infinite. If the radical infinity were to present itself, it presents itself along a spectrum which moves from matter to to the realities of the planes of knowledge, delight, consciousness, and existence. Existence is pure being, conscious being, a superconscience of being. Would there be another kind of existence outside the spectrum? Sri Aurobindo calls it the absolute. That's the philosophical term that would be used for something which is completely unconstrained outside the entire ladder of manifestation. And that's why he's saying, that above, it may be said in Satchidananda itself, above all worlds of manifestation, there could be nothing but the self-awareness of pure existence. Or, indeed, this triune being itself might well be only a trinity of original spiritual self-determinations of the infinite. These two would cease to exist in the ineffable absolute. But the point he's making is that the self-presentation of the absolute, because ultimately this ladder of self-manifestation is a self-presentation of the absolute. A self-presentation of the absolute means that everything that is presented inheres in the absolute. So, existence, consciousness, bliss, and supermind are the intrinsic nature of the absolute. The absolute is not a mystery of infinite blankness, nor a supreme sum of negations. Nothing can manifest that is not justified by some self-power of the original and omnipresent reality. And this is the self-power, the intrinsic self-description, the first self-presentation through which it appears as a manifestation. And hence the absolute is not devoid of meaning or devoid of consciousness or of bliss or of the purity of the presence of existence.
Devashish, is it okay to ask a question?
Sure, please.
When you said the last sentence you spoke, that the Absolute was contained Satchitananda and Supermind, but it's more than that. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, absolutely. Correct.
Thank you.
So I'd like to kind of, I mean, in concluding, since I brought up the whole issue of the aesthetic emotion, and I spoke about how we respond to radical infinity, and Kant's view of the sublime as some kind of including the sense of awe, the two components to the sense of the sublime, according to Kant, are on the one hand a certain degree of fear, which is what we call awe, in the presence of radical infinity that is unconstrained and cannot be understood by us, that goes beyond all order. And then the other dimension, that is that of the emergence of order in the human pole of rationality. See, so he feels that we feel some comfort. We are awed by infinity, but we feel some comfort in the knowledge that order exists, and we intuit it. And our intuition of order causes us to build various forms of order that allows us to have a survival within this radically infinite cosmos. Now, you know, we could take that one step further and say, in that it is not just faith in the human reason, but faith in the presence of an order that is not yet understood by us within this unconstrained infinity. And in fact, the Eastern traditions, on the other hand, for example, the Indian tradition, which has created its aesthetic forms that were viewed by the West as monstrous, you know, gods with many hands, many eyes, many heads, etc., has taken a different kind of view towards the sublime. And that view is one in which radical infinity and its awesome nature is yet felt to have a heart of kindness that is in relation with us. And that relation is a relation that is ultimately one of love, and one that is full of the love that comes from identity, the love that comes from the fact that that alone has become us. This identity is what differs between a philosophy that creates a divide between the creator and the creation, and that which sees the one in all things. So that even in our condition, though the infinite may appear radically infinite and awesome and in a sense monstrous because of that, yet that monstrousness is also intimately known to us. There is a level at which that is in us, that is us, and that spawns a different kind of emotion, an emotion of love, an emotion of knowledge of relation, which is ultimately a track through which we enter into identity.
So, Devajita, when you were talking of, the infinity or the supermind where the knowledge is self-evident, so here we have this yearning for that knowledge, or that yearning for that perfection. So in that supermind, when all this knowledge is self-existent, so then in that status, is there any kind of yearning at all, or is it simply an existence?
Yeah, there is no yearning. No, there is no yearning. Aspiration belongs purely to an evolving ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
There is no aspiration there. But there is a self-perception which is infinite and which is known to itself. So there is a manifestation in supermind. That's why the mother says the supramental manifestation is permanent and has always existed. But the manifestation in supermind coexists with a second manifestation of supermind. And that is our manifestation. Our manifestation is an evolving manifestation of supermind. Because supermind has ultimately become this creation that we experience. It is the creation of evolving ignorance moving towards knowledge. See? So once it achieves, so the involution is completed, once it achieves its own manifestation, once we meet with the manifestation that is always a supramental manifestation, in such a manifestation we'll find that there is a progress, but that progress is not a progress of yearning or aspiring, but a progress of knowledge which unfolds. A manifestation out of a knowledge that already exists. It's the eternal and the temporal that coexist in the sequences of a manifestation. See? Now, what that means is we intuit that also to some extent in our creative activity. So, for example, you may have a plan or an idea, and then you try to work out that idea. And when you're working out that idea, sometimes you don't constantly keep a blueprint in front of your eyes, but the idea has become your action. It has entered, the being has entered into a becoming, you see. So ideas manifest themselves through the way in which they unfold. So similarly, in supermind, the totality is present as knowledge, as an eternity that coexists with its self-unfoldment in time, or as time. So those are the two kind of polarities that coexist in it. In our case, whatever knowledge has entered has become a memory that is hidden under layers of darkness. And therefore, that's the reason why even what we call the psychic being is thought of as a memory of an involution, a memory of something that has plunged into the darkness and not available to us, that also is in a process of becoming. The evolving ignorance is a process of becoming, but a becoming through approximations and through trial and error and through slow remembrance of that which has forgotten itself. That's what brings yearning into it. See, the yearning to remember, the yearning to repossess, the yearning to recover that which is lost.
So then at some point that yearning that we had as we transition to the supermind, it just melts out in that self-perception.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. Its character changes and it becomes a different kind of experience. Totally. That's why the supramental manifestation, as Sri Aurobindo says, and the mother puts it also very strongly, that the difference between the order of existence, it's not just an experience that we have once in a while, but just like the animal has a different kind of existence, a different ontology, different order of experience than the human being, so too the order of experience of supermind is totally different from that of the human. And the gulf between it, she says, is even greater than the gulf between the animal and the human.
Mm-hmm. And then does the character of that yearning change in the overmind too, where it's, you know, does it become more subtle?
Yeah, see, from overmind, from the heights of the overmind, we start losing that sense of yearning, as he's pointing out, you know. But there is still, because at the heights of the overmind, there is a kind of a thin veil, a very thin veil, separating the truth from its projection. So overmind is like a projected reality. And that projected reality yet is close enough so that it knows exactly what is happening. And, you know, that sense of the coexistence of being and becoming is much more clear to it. So the yearning, you may say, goes away already at the heights of the overmind, but the sense of reality is not that great. That's why we may say that in overmind there is still a sense of unreality. And it's only when there is a passage into the supermind that there is a complete knowledge of the knowledge by identity of nothing but the Brahman being in all things.
So if there are no other questions, we'll close out for today and continue the class a couple of Saturdays from now.
Yeah, and we'll be entering, we'll start a new chapter, it's chapter 2 of book 2, part 1.
So that date would be November 30th?
Yes, 29th, I think.
29th, right.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so I'll stop the recording now and we'll continue on the 29th.
Chapter 2 of part 2, correct? Of book 2?
Yeah, it's book 2, part 1, chapter 2.
Okay, thank you, Devashish.
Okay, thank you, Devashish.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye. Thank you.
Thank you, Devashish.
Thank you, Devashish.